isn't happy.
1 minute to walk back in. 1 minute.
Clipping on the ME that did that.
Of fresh lemon juice.
Hot.
And we'll, then fold in
what
your
we'll do
cream.
Is cue Jeff and then eventually mix to the picture store.
And when it's all well mixed, place into individual
no Jeff
dishes.
Division in between them.
Absolutely, yes, mix straight through.
Counting out of VT, 10 seconds, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3,
and cue Jeff.
2,
so you'll need a fresh
1,
pineapple,
6
ounces of marshmallows, 20 maraschino cherries, count them carefully, won't you?
30 seconds.
Cream, back caster in. Sugar, and lemon juice.
And mix.
What will come out next? It's the southeast weather.
You could have left
the
clock.
Like it's
it
going
doesn't
to be another cold, dull day again, much like
20
yesterday.
Seconds.
Coming back to 2.
The top temperature, about 4 degrees centigrade, or 39 Fahrenheit.
Counting to what
and
back
wind,
in? 15, 14, 13,
morning,
12, 11, 10, 9,
dry,
8,
frost.
7,
two,
6,
down
5,
well.
4,
right now,
3,
look,
2, 1,
cut,
0.
Quantel, opt in, go tape.
Here now the words. Greetings. I am Publius, and you, I suppose you know who you are listening to a long-form spoken word presentation on anonradio.net. This is show number 5. You can, as I've mentioned, listen to the previous shows from the Anon Radio archives. And we are continuing with A Princess of Mars by Edgar Rice Burroughs. This time we will be covering chapters 17 through 20, and I'll let you know at this point we're most of the way through the book because the latter chapters are mostly shorter. We're also going to have another snippet of Citadel of Lost Ships by Leigh Brackett, for your listening pleasure. A couple of comments on the chapters from last time. I think you noticed what I meant about a really strong chapter endings. Burroughs really knew how to end those chapters in a way which would leave you waiting for the next one. Some of the chapter titles, such as We Plan Escape, just sound as though they're begging for anagrams. And then the other thing that struck me was his statement there was little or no dust of any description on Mars. Of course, as we know, it's a planet which is blanketed sometimes by months-long global dust storms. Really, sometimes you wonder at the author's powers of observation. Since we are coming up close to the end of A Princess of Mars, I estimate one, maybe two more shows, but two is pushing it. It's a very good thing that I will be reading The Moon Pool by Abraham Merritt this Sunday on the live stream, and I invite you to join me. Easiest way to find it, go to anonradio.net, go to DJs, go to Publius, and there will be a link there that you can follow. Of course, I say that now. I'm recording this Thursday evening, and I will probably spend quite a bit of the night fixing it up so that that becomes true. But you won't need that link until Sunday, sometime after 22 hours UTC. Again, the time I'd like to start would be 22 hours, but the likelihood is it's going to be an hour or more past that. Fortunately, again, any part of the stream that you miss, there are recording functions available, so you can watch it later, or you can just wait until it's transmitted in this format. There will also be a link so you can tip the storyteller on a monthly recurring basis via Patreon. $1 or $3 a month may not mean much to you, but it means a great deal to me. Firstly, that somebody's actually listening to all this. Well, all that having been covered, on with the show. Chapter 17, A Costly Recapture.
As the speaker ceased, he turned to leave the apartment by the door where I was standing. But I needed to wait no longer. I had heard enough to fill my soul with dread, and stealing quietly away, I returned to the courtyard by the way I had come. My plan of action was formed upon the instant, and crossing the square and the bordering avenue upon the opposite side, I soon stood within the courtyard of Talhagis. The brilliantly lighted apartments of the first floor told me where first to seek, and advancing to the windows, I peered within. I soon discovered that my approach was not to be the easy thing I had hoped, for the rear rooms bordering the court were filled with warriors and women. I then glanced up at the stories above, discovering that the third was apparently unlighted, and so decided to make my entrance to the building from that point. It was the work of but a moment for me to reach the windows above, and soon I had drawn myself within the sheltering shadows of the unlighted third floor. Fortunately, the room I had selected was untenanted, and creeping noiselessly to the corridor beyond, I discovered a light in the apartments ahead of me. Reaching what appeared to be a doorway, I discovered that it was but an opening upon an immense inner chamber which towered from the first floor, two stories below me, to the dome-like roof of the building high above my head. The floor of this great circular hall was thronged with chieftains, warriors, and women, and at one end was a great raised platform upon which squatted the most hideous beast I had ever put my eyes upon. He had all the cold, hard, cruel, terrible features of the green warriors, but accentuated and debased by the animal passions to which he had given himself over for many years. There was not a mark of dignity or pride upon his bestial countenance, while his enormous bulk spread itself out upon the platform where he squatted like some huge devilfish, his six limbs accentuating the similarity in a horrible and startling manner. But the sight that froze me with apprehension was that of Deja Thoris and Sola standing there before him, and the fiendish leer of him as he set his great protruding eyes gloat upon the lines of her beautiful figure. She was speaking, but I could not hear what she said, nor could I make out the low grumbling of his reply. She stood there, erect before him, her head high held, and even at the distance I was from them, I could read the scorn and disgust upon her face, as she let her haughty glance rest without sign of fear upon him. She was indeed the proud daughter of a thousand Jeddaks, every inch of her dear, precious little body, so small, so frail beside the towering warriors around her, but in her majesty dwarfing them into insignificance. She was the mightiest figure among them, and I verily believe that they felt it. Presently, Talhagis made a sign that the chamber be cleared, and that the prisoners be left alone before him. Slowly the chieftains, the warriors, and the women melted away into the shadows of the surrounding chambers, and Deja Thoris and Sola stood alone before the Jeddak of the Tharks. One chieftain alone had hesitated before departing. I saw him, standing in the shadows of a mighty column, his fingers nervously toying with the hilt of his great sword, and his cruel eyes bent in implacable hatred upon Talhagis. It was Tars Tarkas, and I could read his thoughts as they were an open book for the undisguised loathing upon his face. He was thinking of that other woman who, 40 years ago, had stood before this beast, and could I have spoken a word into his ear at that moment, the reign of Talhagis would have been over. But finally he strode from the room, not knowing that he left his own daughter at the mercy of the creature he most loathed. Talhagis arose, and I, half fearing, half anticipating his attentions, hurried to the winding runway which led to the floors below. No one was near enough to intercept me, and I reached the main floor of the chamber unobserved, taking my station in the shadow of the same column that Tars Tarkas had but just deserted. As I reached the floor, Talhagis was speaking.
"Princess of Helium, I might wring a mighty ransom from your people would I but return you to them unharmed, but a thousand times rather would I watch that beautiful face writhe in the agony of torture. It shall be long drawn out, that I promise you. 10 days of pleasure were all too short to show the love I harbor for your race. The terrors of your death will haunt the slumbers of the red men through all the ages to come. They will shudder in the shadows of the night as their fathers tell them of the awful vengeance of the green men, of the power and might and hate and cruelty of Talhagis. But before the torture you shall be mine for one short hour, and word of that too shall go forth to Tardos Mors, Jeddak of Helium, your grandfather, that he may grovel upon the ground in the agony of his sorrow. Tomorrow the torture will commence. Tonight thou art Talhagis. Come!"
He sprang down from the platform and grasped her roughly by the arm, but scarcely had he touched her than I leapt between them. My short sword, sharp and gleaming, was in my right hand. I could have plunged it into his putrid heart before he realized that I was upon him, but as I raised my arm to strike, I thought of Tars Tarkas, and with all my rage, with all my hatred, I would not rob him of that sweet moment for which he had lived and hoped all these long, weary years. And so instead I swung my good right fist full upon the point of his jaw. Without a sound, he slipped to the floor as one dead. In the same deathly silence, I grasped Dejah Thoris by the hand, and motioning Sola to follow, we sped noiselessly from the chamber and to the floor above. Unseen, we reached a rear window, and with the straps and leather of my trappings, I lowered first Sola, then Dejah Thoris, to the ground below. Dropping lightly after them, I drew them rapidly around the court in the shadows of the buildings, and thus we returned over the same course I had so recently followed from the distant boundary of the city. We finally came upon my thoats in the courtyard where I had left them, and placing the trappings upon them, we hastened through the building to the avenue beyond. Mounting, Sola upon one beast and Dejah Thoris behind me upon the other, we rode from the city of Thark through the hills to the south. Instead of circling back around the city to the northwest and toward the nearest waterway which lay so short a distance from us, we turned to the northeast and struck out upon the mossy waste which, for 200 dangerous and weary miles, lay another main artery leading to Helium. No word was spoken until we had left the city behind, but I could hear the quiet sobbing of Dejah Thoris as she clung to me, with her dear head resting against my shoulder. "If we make it, my chieftain, the debt of Helium will be a mighty one, greater than she can ever pay you. And should we not make it," she continued, "the debt is no less, though Helium will never know, for you have saved the last of our line from worse than death." I did not answer, but instead reached to my side and pressed the little fingers of her I loved where they clung to me for support, and there in unbroken silence we sped over the yellow moonlit moss, each of us occupied with his own thoughts. For my part, I could not be other than joyful had I tried, with Dejah Thoris' warm body pressed close to mine, and with all our unpassed danger, my heart was singing as gaily as though we were already entering the gates of Helium. Our earlier plans had been so sadly upset that we now found ourselves without food or drink, and I alone was armed. We therefore urged our beasts to a speed that must tell on them sorely before we could hope to sight the ending of the first stage of our journey. We rode all night, and all the following day, with only a few short rests. On the second night, both we and our animals were completely fagged, and so we lay down upon the moss and slept for some 5 or 6 hours, taking up the journey once more before daylight. All the following day we rode, and when, late in the afternoon, we had sighted no distant trees, the mark of the great waterways throughout all Barsoom, the terrible truth flashed upon us. We were lost! Evidently we had circled, but which way it was difficult to say, nor did it seem possible with the sun to guide us by day and the moon and stars by night. At any rate, no waterway was in sight, and the entire party was almost ready to drop from hunger, thirst, and fatigue. Far ahead of us, and a trifle to the right, we could distinguish the outlines of low mountains. These we decided to attempt to reach, in the hope that from some ridge we might discern the missing waterway. Night fell upon us before we reached our goal, and, almost fainting from weariness and weakness, we lay down and slept. I was awakened early in the morning by some huge body pressing close to mine, and opening my eyes with a start, I beheld my blessed old Woola snuggling close to me. The faithful brute had followed us across that trackless waste to share our fate, whatever it might be. Putting my arms around his neck, I pressed my cheek close to his, nor am I ashamed that I did it, nor of the tears that came to my eyes as I thought of his love for me. Shortly after this, Dejah Thoris and Sola awakened, and it was decided that we push on at once in an effort to gain the hills. We had gone scarcely a mile when I noticed that my thoat was commencing to stumble and stagger in a most pitiful manner, although we had not attempted to force them out of a walk since about noon of the preceding day. Suddenly he lurched wildly to one side and pitched violently to the ground. Dejah Thoris and I were thrown clear of him and fell upon the soft moss with scarcely a jar, but the poor beast was in a pitiable condition, not even being able to rise, although relieved of our weight. Sola told me that the coolness of the night, when it fell, together with the rest, would doubtless revive him, and so I decided not to kill him, as was my first intention, as I had thought it cruel to leave him there alone to die of hunger and thirst. Relieving him of his trappings, which I flung down beside him, we left the poor fellow to his fate, and pushed on with the one thoat as best we could. Sola and I walked, making Dejah Thoris ride, much against her will. In this way we had progressed to within a mile of the hills we were endeavoring to reach, when Dejah Thoris, from her point of vantage upon the thoat, cried out that she saw a great party of mounted men filing down from a pass in the hills several miles away. Sola and I both looked in the direction she indicated, and there, plainly discernible, were several hundred mounted warriors. They seemed to be headed in a southwesterly direction, which would take them away from us. They doubtless were Thark warriors who had been sent out to capture us, and we breathed a great sigh of relief that they were traveling in the opposite direction. Quickly lifting Dejah Thoris down from the thoat, I commanded the animal to lie down, and we three did the same, presenting as small an object as possible, for fear of attracting the attention of the warriors toward us. We could see them as they filed out of the pass just for an instant before they were lost to view behind a friendly ridge, to us a most providential ridge, since had they been in view for any great length of time, they scarcely could have failed to discover us. As what proved to be the last warrior came into view from the pass, he halted and, to our consternation, threw his small, powerful field glass to his eye and scanned the sea bottom in all directions. Evidently, he was a chieftain, for in certain marching formations among the green men, a chieftain brings up the extreme rear of the column. As his glass swung toward us, our hearts stopped in our breasts, and I could feel the cold sweat start from every pore in my body. Presently, it swung full upon us and stopped. The tension on our nerves was near the breaking point, and I doubt if any of us breathed for the few minutes he held us covered by his glass. And then he lowered it, and we could hear him shout a command to the warriors who had passed from our sight behind the ridge. He did not wait for them to join him, however. Instead, he wheeled his thoat and came tearing madly in our direction. There was but one slight chance, and that we must take quickly. Raising my strange Martian rifle to my shoulder, I sighted and touched the button which controlled the trigger. There was a sharp explosion as the missile reached its goal, and the charging chieftain pitched backwards from his flying mount. Springing to my feet, I urged the thoat to rise and directed Sola to take Deja Thoris with her upon him and make a mighty effort to reach the hills before the green warriors were upon us. I knew that in the ravines and gullies they might find a temporary hiding place, and even though they died there of hunger and thirst, it would be better so than that they fell into the hands of the Tharks. Forcing my two revolvers upon them as a slight means of protection, and as a last resort, as an escape for themselves from the horrid death which recapture would surely mean, I lifted Deja Thoris in my arms and placed her upon the thoat behind Sola, who had already mounted at my command. "Goodbye, my princess," I whispered. "We may meet in Helium yet. I have escaped from worse plights than this," and I tried to smile as I lied. "What?" she cried. "Are you not coming with us?" "How may I, Deja Thoris? Someone must hold these fellows off for a while, and I can better escape from them alone than could the three of us together." She sprang quickly from the thoat, and throwing her dear arms about me, turned to Sola, saying with quiet dignity, "Fly, Sola! Deja Thoris remains to die with the man she loves." These words are engraved upon my heart. Ah, gladly would I give up my life 1,000 times could I only hear them once again. But I could not then give even a second to the rapture of her sweet embrace, and pressing my lips to hers for the first time, I picked her up bodily and tossed her to her seat behind Sola again, commanding the latter in peremptory tones to hold her there by force, and then, slapping the thoat upon the flank, I saw them borne away, Deja Thoris struggling to the last to free herself from Sola's grasp. Turning, I beheld the green warriors mounting the ridge and looking for their chieftain. In a moment they saw him, and then me, but scarcely had they discovered me, than I commenced firing, lying flat upon my belly in the moss. I had an even 100 rounds in the magazine of my rifle, and another 100 in the belt at my back, and I kept up a continuous stream of fire until I saw all the warriors who had been first to return from behind the ridge, either dead or scurrying for cover. My respite was short-lived, however, for soon the whole party, numbering some 1,000 men, came charging into view, racing madly toward me. I fired until my rifle was empty, and they were almost upon me, and then a glance showing me that Deja Thoris and Sola had disappeared among the hills, I sprang up, throwing down my useless gun, and started away in the direction opposite to that taken by Sola and her charge. If ever Martians had an exhibition of jumping, it was granted to those astonished warriors on that day long years ago, but while it led them away from Deja Thoris, it did not distract their attention from endeavoring to capture me. They raced wildly after me until, finally, my foot struck a protruding piece of quartz, and down I went, sprawling upon the moss. As I looked up, they were upon me, and although I drew my long sword in an attempt to sell my life as dearly as possible, it was soon over. I reeled beneath their blows, which fell upon me in perfect torrents. My head swam. All was black, and I went down beneath them to oblivion. Chapter 18. Chained in Warhoon. It must have been several hours before I regained consciousness, and I well remember the feeling of surprise which swept over me as I realized that I was not dead. I was lying among a pile of sleeping silks and furs in the corner of a small room, in which were several green warriors, and bending over me was an ancient and ugly female. As I opened my eyes, she turned to one of the warriors, saying, "He will live, O Jed." "'Tis well," replied the one so addressed, rising and approaching my couch. "He should render rare sport for the great games." And now, as my eyes fell upon him, I saw that he was no Thark, for his ornaments and metal were not of that hoard. He was a huge fellow, terribly scarred about the face and chest, and with one broken tusk and a missing ear. Strapped on either breast were human skulls, and depending from these a number of dried human hands. His reference to the great games, of which I had heard so much while among the Tharks, convinced me that I had but jumped from purgatory into Gehenna. After a few more words of the female, during which she assured him that I was now fully fit to travel, the Jed ordered that we mount and ride after the main column. I was strapped securely to as wild and unmanageable a thote as I had ever seen, and, with a mounted warrior on either side to prevent the beast from bolting, we rode forth at a furious pace in pursuit of the column. My wounds gave me but little pain, so wonderfully and rapidly had the applications and injections of the female exercised their therapeutic powers, and so deftly had she bound and plastered the injuries. Just before dark, we reached the main body of troops shortly after they had made camp for the night. I was immediately taken before the leader, who proved to be the Jeddak of the hordes of Warhoon. Like the Jed who had brought me, he was frightfully scarred, and also decorated with the breastplate of human skulls and dried dead hands, which seemed to mark all the greater warriors among the Warhoons, as well as to indicate their awful ferocity, which greatly transcends even that of the Tharks. The Jeddak, Bar Comus, who was comparatively young, was the object of the fierce and jealous hatred of his old lieutenant, Dak Kova, the Jed who had captured me, and I could not but note the almost studied efforts which the latter made to affront his superior. He entirely omitted the usual formal salutation as we entered the presence of the Jeddak, and as he pushed me roughly before the ruler, he exclaimed in a loud and menacing voice, "I have brought a strange creature wearing the metal of a Thark, whom it is my pleasure to have battle with a wild thote at the great games." "He will die as Bar Comus, your Jeddak, sees fit, if at all," replied the young ruler, with emphasis and dignity. "If at all?" roared Dak Kova. "By the dead hands at my throat, but he shall die, Bar Comus! No maudlin weakness on your part shall save him. Oh, would that Warhoon were ruled by a real Jeddak, than by a water-hearted weakling from whom old Dak Kova could tear the metal with his bare hands!" Bar Comus eyed the defiant and insubordinate chieftain for an instant, his expression one of haughty, fearless contempt and hate, and then without drawing a weapon and without uttering a word, he hurled himself at the throat of his defamer. I had never before seen two green Martian warriors battle with nature's weapons, and the exhibition of animal ferocity which ensued was as fearful a thing as the most disordered imagination could picture. They tore at each other's ears and eyes with their hands, and with their gleaming tusks repeatedly slashed and gored until both were fairly cut to ribbons from head to foot. Bar Comus had much the better of the battle, as he was stronger, quicker, and more intelligent. It soon seemed that the encounter was done, saving only the final death thrust, when Bar Comus slipped in breaking away from a clinch. It was the one little opening that Dak Kova needed, and hurling himself at the body of his adversary, he buried his single mighty tusk in Bar Comus' groin, and with a last powerful effort, ripped the young Jeddak wide open the full length of his body, the great tusk finally wedging in the bones of Bar Comus' jaw. Victor and vanquished rolled limp and lifeless upon the moss, a huge mass of torn and bloody flesh. Bar Comus was stone dead, and only the most Herculean efforts on the part of Dak Kova's females saved him from the fate he deserved. 3 days later, he walked without assistance to the body of Bar Comus, which, by custom, had not been moved from where it fell, and placing his foot upon the neck of his erstwhile ruler, he assumed the title of Jeddak of Warhoon. The dead Jeddak's hands and head were removed to be added to the ornaments of the conqueror, and then his women cremated what remained amidst wild and terrible laughter. The injuries to Dak Kova had delayed the march so greatly that it was decided to give up the expedition, which was a raid upon a small Thark community in retaliation for the destruction of the incubator, until after the great games, and the great body of warriors, 10,000 in number, turned back toward Warhoon. My introduction to these cruel and bloodthirsty people was but an index to the scenes I witnessed almost daily while with them. They are a smaller horde than the Tharks, but much more ferocious. Not a day passed but that some members of the various Warhoon communities met in deadly combat. I have seen as high as 8 mortal duels within a single day. We reached the city of Warhoon after some 3 days' march, and I was immediately cast into a dungeon and heavily chained to the floor and walls. Food was brought me at intervals, but owing to the utter darkness of the place, I do not know whether I lay there days, or weeks, or months. It was the most horrible experience of all my life, and that my mind did not give way to the terrors of that inky blackness has been a wonder to me ever since. The place was filled with creeping, crawling things. Cold, sinuous bodies passed over me when I lay down, and in the darkness I occasionally caught glimpses of gleaming, fiery eyes fixed in horrible intentness upon me. No sound reached me from the world above, and no word would my jailer vouchsafe when my food was brought to me, although I at first bombarded him with questions. Finally, all the hatred and maniacal loathing for these awful creatures who had placed me in this horrible place was centered by my tottering reason upon this single emissary who represented to me the whole horde of Warhoons. I had noticed that he always advanced with his dim torch to where he could place the food within my reach, and as he stooped to place it upon the floor, his head was about on a level with my breast. So, with the cunning of a madman, I backed into the far corner of my cell when next I heard him approaching, and gathering a little slack of the great chain which held me in my hand, I waited his coming, crouching like some beast of prey. As he stooped to place my food upon the ground, I swung the chain above my head and crashed the links with all my strength upon his skull. Without a sound, he slipped to the floor, stone dead. Laughing and chattering like the idiot I was fast becoming, I fell upon his prostrate form, my fingers feeling for his dead throat. Presently they came in contact with a small chain, at the end of which dangled a number of keys. The touch of my fingers on these keys brought back my reason with the suddenness of thought. No longer was I a gibbering idiot, but a sane reasoning man with the means of escape within my very hands. As I was groping to remove the chain from about my victim's neck, I glanced up into the darkness to see six pairs of gleaming eyes fixed unwinking upon me. Slowly they approached, and slowly I shrank back from the awful horror of them. Back into my corner I crouched, holding my hands, palms out, before me, and stealthily on came the awful eyes until they reached the dead body at my feet. Then slowly they retreated, but this time with a strange grating sound, and finally they disappeared in some black and distant recess of my dungeon. Chapter 19. Battling in the Arena. Slowly I regained my composure, and finally essayed again to attempt to remove the keys from the dead body of my former jailer. But as I reached out into the darkness to locate it, I found to my horror that it was gone. Then the truth flashed on me. The owners of those gleaming eyes had dragged my prize away from me to be devoured in their neighboring lair. As they had been waiting for days, for weeks, for months, through all this awful eternity of my imprisonment, to drag my dead carcass to their feast. For 2 days no food was brought to me, but then a new messenger appeared, and my incarceration went on as before, but not again did I allow my reason to be submerged by the horror of my position. Shortly after this episode another prisoner was brought in, and chained me near me. By the dim torchlight I saw that he was a red Martian, and I could scarcely await the departure of his guards to address him. As their retreating footsteps died away in the distance, I called out softly the Martian word of greeting, Kaor. "Who are you who speaks out of the darkness?" he answered. "John Carter, a friend of the Red Men of Helium." "I am of Helium," he said, "but I do not recall your name." And then I told him of my story as I have written it here, omitting only any reference to my love for Deja Thoris. He was much excited by the news of Helium's princess, and seemed quite positive that she and Sola could easily have reached a point of safety from where they left me. He said that he knew the place well, because the defile through which the Warhoon warriors had passed when they discovered us was the only one ever used by them when marching to the south. Deja Thoris and Sola entered the hills not 5 miles from a great waterway, and are now probably quite safe, he assured me. My fellow prisoner was Kantos Khan, a padwar or lieutenant in the Navy of Helium. He had been a member of the ill-fated expedition which had fallen into the hands of the Tharks at the time of Deja Thoris' capture, and he briefly related the events which followed the defeat of the battleships. Badly injured and only partially manned, they had limped slowly toward Helium, but while passing near the city of Zodanga, the capital of Helium's hereditary enemies among the Red Men of Barsoom, they had been attacked by a great body of war vessels, and all but the craft to which Kantos Khan belonged were destroyed or captured. His vessel was chased for days by 3 of the Zodangan warships, but finally escaped during the darkness of a moonless night. 30 days after the capture of Deja Thoris, or about the time of our coming to Thark, his vessel had reached Helium with about 10 survivors of the original crew of 700 officers and men. Immediately, 7 great fleets, each of 100 mighty warships, had been dispatched to search for Deja Thoris, and from these vessels 2,000 smaller craft had been kept out continuously in futile search for the missing princess. 2 green Martian communities had been wiped off the face of Barsoom by the avenging fleets, but no trace of Deja Thoris had been found. They had been searching among the northern hordes, and only within the past few days had they extended their quest to the south. Kantos Khan had been detailed to one of the small one-man flyers, and had the misfortune to be discovered by the Warhoons while exploring their city. The bravery and daring of the man won my greatest respect and admiration. Alone, he had landed at the city's boundary, and on foot had penetrated to the buildings surrounding the plaza. For 2 days and nights, he had explored their quarters and their dungeons in search of his beloved princess, only to fall into the hands of a party of warhoons as he was about to leave, after assuring himself that Dejah Thoris was not a captive there. During the period of our incarceration, Kantos Khan and I became well acquainted and formed a warm personal friendship. A few days only elapsed, however, before we were dragged forth from our dungeon for the great games. We were conducted early one morning to an enormous amphitheater, which, instead of having been built upon the surface of the ground, was excavated below the surface. It was partially filled with debris, so that how large it had originally been was hard to say. In its present condition, it held the entire 20,000 warhoons of the assembled hordes. The arena was immense, but extremely uneven and unkempt. Around it, the warhoons had piled building stone from some of the ruined edifices of the ancient city to prevent the animals and the captives from escaping into the audience, and at each end had been constructed cages to hold them until their turns came to meet some horrible death upon the arena. Kantos Khan and I were confined together in one of the cages. In the others were wild Kalots, Thotes, mad Zitadars, green warriors, and women of other hordes, and many strange and ferocious wild beasts of Barsoom which I had never before seen. The din of their roaring, growling, and squealing was deafening, and the formidable appearance of any one of them was enough to make the stoutest heart feel grave forebodings. Kantos Khan explained to me that at the end of the day one of these prisoners would gain freedom, and the others would lie dead about the arena. The winners in the various contests of the day would be pitted against each other until only two remained alive, the victor in the last encounter being set free, whether animal or man. The following morning, the cages would be filled with a new consignment of victims, and so on throughout the 10 days of the games. Shortly after we had been caged, the amphitheater began to fill, and within an hour every available part of the seating place was occupied. Dak Kova, with his Jeds and Chieftains, sat at the center of one side of the arena upon a large, raised platform. At a signal from Dak Kova, the doors of two cages were thrown open, and a dozen green Martian females were driven to the center of the arena. Each was given a dagger, and then at the far end, a pack of 12 Kalots, or wild dogs, was loosed upon them. As the brutes, growling and foaming, rushed upon the almost defenseless women, I turned my head that I might not see the horrid sight. The yells and laughter of the green horde bore witness to the excellent quality of the sport, and when I turned back to the arena, as Kantos Khan told me it was over, I saw three victorious Kalots snarling and growling over the bodies of their prey. The women had given a good account of themselves. Next, a mad Zitadar was loosed among the remaining dogs, and so it went throughout the long, hot, horrible day. During the day I was pitted against first men and then beasts, but as I was armed with a long sword and always outclassed my adversary in agility, and generally its strength as well, it proved but child's play to me. Time and again I won the applause of the bloodthirsty multitude. And toward the end there were cries that I be taken from the arena, and be made a member of the hordes of Warhoon. Finally there were but three of us left, a great warrior of some far northern horde, Kantos Khan, and myself. The other two were to battle, and then I to fight the conqueror for the liberty which was accorded the final victor. Kantos Khan had fought several times during the day, and like myself had always proven victorious, but occasionally by the smallest of margins, especially when pitted against the green warriors. I had little hope that he could best his giant adversary, who had mowed down all before him during the day. This fellow towered nearly 16 feet in height, while Kantos Khan was some inches under 6 feet. As they advanced to meet one another, I saw for the first time a trick of Martian swordsmanship, which centers Kantos Khan's every hope of victory in life on one cast of the dice. For as he came to within about 20 feet of the huge fellow, he threw his sword arm far behind him over his shoulder, and with a mighty sweep hurled his weapon point foremost at the green warrior. It flew true as an arrow, and piercing the poor devil's heart, laid him dead upon the arena. Kantos Khan and I were now pitted against each other, but as we approached into the encounter, I whispered to him to prolong the battle until nearly dark in the hope that we might find some means of escape. The horde evidently guessed that we had no heart to fight each other, and so they howled in a rage as neither of us placed a fatal thrust. Just as I saw the sudden coming of dark, I whispered to Kantos Khan to thrust his sword between my left arm and my body. As he did so, I staggered back, clasping the sword tightly with my arm, and thus fell to the ground with his weapon apparently protruding from my chest. Kantos Khan perceived my coup, and stepping quickly to one side, he placed his foot upon my neck, and withdrawing his sword from my body, gave me the final death blow through the neck, which is supposed to sever the jugular vein. But in this instance, the cold blade slipped harmlessly into the sand of the arena. In the darkness which had now fallen, none could tell but that he had really finished me. I whispered to him to go and claim his freedom, and then look for me in the hills east of the city, and so he left me. When the amphitheater had cleared, I crept stealthily to the top, and as the great excavation lay far from the plaza and in an untenanted portion of the great dead city, I had but little trouble in reaching the hills beyond. Chapter 20. In the Atmosphere Factory. For 2 days, I waited there for Kantos Khan, but as he did not come, I started off on foot in a northwesterly direction toward a point where he had told me lay the nearest waterway. My only food consisted of vegetable milk from the plants which gave so bounteously of this priceless fluid. Through 2 long weeks I wandered, stumbling through the nights guided only by the stars, and hiding during the days behind some protruding rock or among the occasional hills I traversed. Several times I was attacked by wild beasts, strange, uncouth monstrosities that leapt upon me in the dark, so that I had ever to grasp my long sword in my hand that I might be ready for them. Usually my strange, newly acquired telepathic power warned me in ample time, but once I was down with vicious fangs pressed to my jugular and a hairy face pressed close to mine before I knew that I was even threatened. What manner of thing was upon me, I did not know, but that it was large and heavy and many-legged I could feel. My hands were at its throat before the fangs had had a chance to bury themselves in my neck, and slowly I forced the hairy face from me and closed my fingers vice-like upon its windpipe. Without sound we lay there, the beast exerting every effort to reach me with those awful fangs, and I straining to maintain my grip and choke the life from it as I kept it from my throat. Slowly my arms gave to the unequal struggle, and inch by inch the burning eyes and gleaming tusks of my antagonist crept toward me, until, as the hairy face touched mine again, I realized that all was over. And then a living mass of destruction sprang from the surrounding darkness, full upon the creature that held me pinioned to the ground. The two rolled, growling upon the moss, tearing and rending one another in a most frightful manner, but it was soon over, and my preserver stood with lowered head above the throat of the dead thing which would have killed me. The nearer moon, hurtling suddenly above the horizon and lighting up the Barsoomian scene, showed me that my preserver was Wula, but from whence he had come, or how he found me, I was at a loss to know. That I was glad of his companionship, it is needless to say, but my pleasure at seeing him was tempered by anxiety as to the reason of his leaving Deja Thoris. Only her death, I felt sure, could account for his absence from her, so faithful I knew him to be to my commands. By the light of the now brilliant moons, I saw that he was but a shadow of his former self, and as he turned from my caress and commenced greedily to devour the dead carcass at my feet, I realized that the poor fellow was more than half starved. I myself was in but little better plight, but I could not bring myself to eat the uncooked flesh, and I had no means of making a fire. When Wula had finished his meal, I again took up my weary and seemingly endless wandering in quest of the elusive waterway. At daybreak of the 15th day of my search, I was overjoyed to see the high trees that denoted the object of my search. About noon, I dragged myself wearily to the portals of a huge building, which covered perhaps 4 square miles and towered 200 feet in the air. It showed no aperture in the mighty walls other than the tiny door at which I sank exhausted, nor was there any sign of life about it. I could find no bell or other method of making my presence known to the inmates of the place, unless a small round hole in the wall near the door was for that purpose. It was of about the bigness of a lead pencil, and thinking that it might be in the nature of a speaking tube, I put my mouth to it and was about to call into it, when a voice issued from it asking me whom I might be, where from, and the nature of my errand. I explained that I had escaped from the Warhoons and was dying of starvation and exhaustion. "You wear the metal of a green warrior and are followed by a calotte, yet you are of the figure of a red man. In color you are neither green nor red. In the name of the ninth day, what manner of creature are you?" "I am a friend of the red men of Barsoom, and I am starving. In the name of humanity, open to us," I replied. Presently, the door commenced to recede before me until it had sunk into the wall 50 feet. Then it stopped and slid easily to the left, exposing a short, narrow corridor of concrete, at the farther end of which was another door similar in every respect to the one I had just passed. No one was in sight, yet immediately we passed the first door, it slid gently into place behind us and receded rapidly to its original position in the front wall of the building. As the door had slipped aside, I noted its great thickness, fully 20 feet, and as it reached its place once more after closing behind us, great cylinders of steel had dropped from the ceiling behind it and fitted their lower ends into apertures countersunk in the floor. A second and a third door receded before me and slipped to one side as the first, before I reached a large inner chamber where I found food and drink set out upon a great stone table. A voice directed me to satisfy my hunger and to feed my calotte, and while I was thus engaged, my invisible host put me through a severe and searching cross-examination. "Your statements are most remarkable," said the voice, on concluding its questioning. "But you are evidently speaking the truth, and it is equally evident that you are not of Barsoom. I can tell that by the conformation of your brain, and by the strange location of your internal organs, and of the shape and size of your heart."
"Can you see through me?" I exclaimed.
"Yes. I can see all but your thoughts, and were you a Barsoomian, I could read those."
Then a door opened up at the far side of the chamber, and a strange, dried-up little mummy of a man came toward me. He wore but a single article of clothing or adornment, a small collar of gold, from which depended upon his chest a great ornament, as large as a dinner plate, set solid with huge diamonds, except for the exact center, which was occupied by a strange stone, an inch in diameter, that scintillated 9 different and distinct rays. The 7 colors of our earthly prism, and 2 beautiful rays which, to me, were new and nameless. I cannot describe them any more than you could describe red to a blind man. I only know that they were beautiful in the extreme. The old man sat and talked with me for hours, and the strangest part of our intercourse was that I could read his every thought, while he could not fathom an iota from my mind unless I spoke. I did not apprise him of my ability to sense his mental operations, and thus I learned a great deal which proved of immense value to me later, and which I would never have known had he suspected my strange power, for the Martians have such perfect control of their mental machinery that they are able to direct their thoughts with absolute precision. The building in which I found myself contained the machinery which produces that artificial atmosphere which sustains life on Mars. The secret of the entire process hinges on the use of the 9th ray, one of the beautiful scintillations which I had noted emanating from the great stone in my host's diadem. This ray is separated from the other rays of the sun by means of finely adjusted instruments placed upon the roof of the huge building, 3/4 of which is used for reservoirs in which the 9th ray is stored. This product is then treated electrically, or rather certain proportions of refined electric vibrations are incorporated with it, and the result is then pumped to the 5 principal air centers of the planet, where, as it is released, contact with the ether of space transforms it into atmosphere. There is always a sufficient reserve of the 9th ray stored in the great building to maintain the present Martian atmosphere for 1,000 years, and the only fear, as my new friend told me, was that some accident might befall the pumping apparatus. He led me to an inner chamber where I beheld a battery of 20 radium pumps, any one of which was equal to the task of furnishing all Mars with the atmosphere compound. For 800 years, he told me, he had watched these pumps, which are used alternately, a day each at a stretch, or a little over 24.5 Earth hours. He has one assistant who divides the watch with him. Half a Martian year, about 344 of our days, each of these men spend alone in this huge, isolated plant. Every red Martian is taught during earliest childhood the principles of the manufacture of atmosphere, but only 2 at one time ever hold the secret of ingress to the great building, which, built as it is with walls 150 feet thick, is absolutely unassailable, even the roof being guarded from assault by aircraft by a glass covering 5 feet thick. The only fear they entertain of attack is from green Martians, or some demented red man, as all Barsoomians realize, that the very existence of every form of life on Mars is dependent upon the uninterrupted working of this plant. One curious fact I discovered as I watched his thoughts was that the outer doors are manipulated by telepathic means. The locks are so finely adjusted that the doors are released by the action of a certain combination of thought waves. To experiment with my newfound toy, I thought to surprise him into revealing this combination, and so I asked him in a casual manner how he had managed to unlock the massive doors for me from the inner chambers of the building. As quick as a flash, there leapt to his mind 9 Martian sounds, but as quickly faded as he answered that this was a secret he must not divulge. From then on, his manner towards me changed, as though he feared that he had been surprised into divulging his great secret, and I read suspicion and fear in his looks and thoughts, though his words were still fair. Before I retired for the night, he promised to give me a letter to a nearby agricultural officer who would help me on my way to Zodanga, which he said was the nearest Martian city.
"But be sure that you do not let them know that you are bound for Helium, as they are at war with that country. My assistant and I are of no country. We belong to all Barsoom, and this talisman which we wear protects us in all lands, even among the green men, though we do not trust ourselves to their hands if we can avoid it," he added. "And so, good night, my friend," he continued. "May you have a long and restful sleep. Oh, yes, a long sleep."
And though he smiled pleasantly, I saw in his thoughts the wish that he had never admitted me, and then a picture of him standing over me in the night, and the swift thrust of a long dagger, and the half-formed words, "I am sorry, but it is for the best good of Barsoom." As he closed the door of my chamber behind him, his thoughts were cut off from me, as was the sight of him, which seemed strange to me in my little knowledge of thought transference.
What was I to do? How could I escape through these mighty walls? Easily could I kill him now that I was warned, but once he was dead I could no more escape, and with the stopping of the machinery of the great plant I should die with all the other inhabitants of the planet, all, even Deja Thoris, were she not already dead. For the others I did not give the snap of a finger, but the thought of Deja Thoris drove from my mind all desire to kill my mistaken host. Cautiously I opened the door of my apartment, and, followed by Wula, sought the inner of the great doors. A wild scheme had come to me. I would attempt to force the great locks by the 9 thought waves I had read in my host's mind. Creeping stealthily through corridor after corridor, and down winding runways which turned hither and thither, I finally reached the great hall in which I had broken my long fast that morning. Nowhere had I seen my host, nor did I know where he kept himself by night. I was on the point of stepping boldly out into the room, when a slight noise behind me warned me back into the shadows of a recess in the corridor. Dragging Wula after me, I crouched low in the darkness. Presently the old man passed close by me, and as he entered the dimly lighted chamber which I had been about to pass through, I saw that he held a long, thin dagger in his hand, and that he was sharpening it upon a stone. In his mind was the decision to inspect the radium pumps, which would take about 30 minutes, and then return to my bedchamber and finish me. As he passed through the great hall, and disappeared down the runway which led to the pump room, I stole stealthily from my hiding place, and crossed to the great door, the inner of the three which stood between me and liberty. Concentrating my mind upon the massive lock, I hurled the 9 thought waves against it. In breathless expectancy I waited, when finally the great door moved softly toward me and slid quietly to one side. One after the other the remaining mighty portals opened at my command, and Wula and I stepped forth into the darkness, free, but little better off than we had been before, other than that we had full stomachs. Hastening away from the shadows of the formidable pile, I made for the first crossroad, intending to strike the central turnpike as quickly as possible. This I reached about morning, and entering the first enclosure I came to, I searched for some evidence of habitation. There were long, low, rambling buildings of concrete, barred with heavy impassable doors, and no amount of hammering and hallooing brought any response. Weary and exhausted from sleeplessness, I threw myself upon the ground, commanding Wula to stand guard. Some time later, I was awakened by his frightful growlings, and opened my eyes to see 3 red Martians standing a short distance from us and covering me with their rifles. "I am unarmed and no enemy," I hastened to explain. "I have been a prisoner among the green men, and am on my way to Zodanga. All I ask is food and rest for myself and my Kalat, and the proper directions for reaching my destination." They lowered their rifles and advanced pleasantly toward me, placing their right hands upon my left shoulder, after the manner of their custom of salute, and asking me many questions about myself and my wanderings. The buildings I had been hammering on at the early morning were occupied only by stock and farm produce, the house proper standing among a grove of enormous trees, and like all red Martian homes had been raised at night some 40 or 50 feet above the ground on a large round metal shaft which slid up and down within a sleeve sunk in the ground, and was operated by a tiny radium engine in the entrance hall of the building. Instead of bothering with bolts and bars for their dwellings, the red Martians simply run them up out of harm's way during the night. They also have private means for lowering or raising them from the ground without, if they wish to go away and leave them. These brothers, with their wives and children, occupied 3 similar houses on this farm. They did no work themselves, being government officers in charge. The labor was performed by convicts, prisoners of war, delinquent debtors, and confirmed bachelors who were too poor to pay the high celibate tax which all Red Martian governments impose. They were the personification of cordiality and hospitality, and I spent several days with them, resting and recuperating from my long and arduous experiences. When they had heard my story, I omitted all reference to Deja Thoris and the old men of the atmosphere plant, they advised me to color my body to more nearly resemble their own race, and then attempt to find employment in Zodanga, either in the army or the navy. The chances are small that your tale will be believed until after you have proven your trustworthiness and won friends among the higher nobles of the court. This you can most easily do through military service, as we are a warlike people on Barsoom, explained one of them, and save our richest favors for the fighting man. When I was ready to depart, they furnished me with a small domestic bull thoat, such as used for all saddle purposes by Red Martians. The animal is about the size of a horse and quite gentle, but in color and shape an exact replica of his fierce and huge cousin of the wilds. The brothers had supplied me with a reddish oil, with which I anointed my entire body, and one of them cut my hair, which had grown quite long, in the prevailing fashion of the time, square at the back and banged in the front, so that I could have passed anywhere upon Barsoom as a full-fledged red Martian. My metal and ornaments were also renewed in the style of a Zodangan gentleman, attached to the house of Ptor, which was the family name of my benefactors.
They filled a little sack on my side with Zodangan money. The medium of exchange upon Mars is not dissimilar from our own, except that the coins are oval. Paper money is issued by individuals as they require it and redeemed twice yearly. If a man issues more than he can redeem, the government pays his creditors in full, and the debtor works out the amount upon the farms or in mines, which are all owned by the government. This suits everybody except the debtor, as it has been found a difficult thing to obtain sufficient voluntary labor to work the great isolated farmlands of Mars, stretching as they do, like narrow ribbons from pole to pole, through wild stretches peopled by wilder animals and wilder men. When I mentioned my inability to repay them for their kindness to me, they assured me that I would have ample opportunity if I lived long upon Barsoom, and bidding me farewell, they watched me until I was out of sight upon the broad white turnpike.
Part 2. There was one thing about the Venusian atmosphere. You couldn't see through it, even with infrabeams, at very long range. The intensity needle showed the patrol ship still far off, probably not suspicious yet, although stray craft were rare over the swamps. In a minute, the copper would be calling for information, with his mass detectors giving the stray a massage. Campbell didn't think he'd wait. He slammed in the drive rockets, holding them down till the tubes warmed. Even held down, they had plenty. The ship climbed in a whipping spiral. The red light wavered, died, glowed again. This cop was good with his beam. Campbell fed in more juice. The red light died again, but the patrol boat had all its beams out now, spread like a fishnet. The small ship struck another, lost it, struck again, and this time didn't break out. Campbell felt the sudden racking jar all through him. "Tractor beams," he said. "You think so, friend?" The drive jets were really warming now. He shot it to them. The ship hung for a fractional instant, her triple-braced hull shuddering so that Campbell's teeth rang together. Then she broke, blasting up right through the netted beams. Campbell jockeyed his port and starboard steering jets. The ship leapt and skittered wildly. The cop didn't have time to focus full power on him anywhere, and low power was a nuisance and nothing more. Campbell went up over the patrol ship, veered off in the opposite direction from the one he intended to follow, hung in a tight spiral until he was sure he was clean, and then dived again. The patrol boat wasn't expecting him to come back. The pilot was concentrating on where Campbell had gone, not where he had been. Campbell grinned, opened full throttle, and went skittering over the curve of the planet to meet the night shadow rushing toward him. He didn't meet any more ships. He was way off the trade lanes, and moving so fast that only blind luck could tag him. He hoped the patrol was hunting for him in force back where they'd lost him. He hoped they'd hunt a long time. Presently, he climbed on slowed and muffled jets out of the atmosphere. His black ship melted indistinguishably into the black shadow of the planet. He slowed still more, just balancing the Venus drag, and crawled out toward a spot marked on his chart. An out-of-patrol boat went by, too far off to bother about. Campbell lit a cigarette with nervous hands. It was only a quarter smoked when the object he'd been waiting for loomed up in space. His infrabeam showed it clearly, a round, plate-shaped mass about a mile in diameter, built of three tiers of spaceships. Hulks, ancient, rusty, pitted things that had died and not been decently buried, welded together in a solid mass by lengths of pipe let into their carcasses. Before, when he'd seen it, Campbell had been in too much of a hurry to do more than curse it for getting in his way. Now he thought it was the most desolate, godforsaken mass of junk that had ever made him wonder why people bothered to live at all. He touched the throttle, tempted to go back to the swamps. Then he thought of what was going to happen back there and took his hand away. "Hell," he said. "I might as well look inside." He didn't know anything about the internal setup of Romany, what made it tick, and how. He knew Romany didn't love the Coalition, but whether they would run to harboring criminals was another thing. It wouldn't be strange if they'd been given pictures of Roy Campbell and told to watch for him. Thinking of the size of the reward for him, Campbell wished he were not quite so famous. Romany reminded him of an old-fashioned circular mousetrap. Once inside, it wouldn't be easy to get out. "Of all the platinum-plated saps!" he snarled suddenly. "Why am I sticking my neck out for a bunch of semi-human swamp crawlers, anyhow?" He didn't answer that. The leading edge of Romany knifed towards him. There were lights in some of the hulks, mostly in the top layer. Campbell reached for the radio. He had to contact the big shots. No one else could give him what he needed. To do that, he had to walk right up to the front door and announce himself. After that, the manual listed the wavelength he wanted. He juggled the dials and verniers, wishing his hands wouldn't sweat. "Spaceship Black Star calling Romany, calling Romany." His screen flashed, flickered, and cleared. Romany acknowledging, "Who are you, and what do you want?" Campbell's screen showed him a youngish man, a Taxil, he thought, from some Mercurian backwater. He was ebony black and handsome, and he looked as though the sight of Campbell affected him like stale beer. Campbell said, "Cordial guy, aren't you? I'm Thomas Black, trader out of Terra, and I want to come aboard." "That requires permission." "Yeah? Okay, connect me with the boss." The Taxil now looked as though he smelled something that had been dead a long time. "Possibly you mean Aaron Mack, the chief counselor?" "Possibly," Campbell admitted, "I do." If the rest of the gypsies were anything like this one, they sure had a hate on for outsiders. Well, he didn't blame them. The screen blurred. It stayed that way while Campbell smoked 3 cigarettes and exhausted his excellent vocabulary. Then it cleared abruptly. Aaron Mack sounded Martian, but the man pictured on the screen was no Martian. He was an Earthman, with a face like a wedge of granite and a frame that was all gaunt bones and thrusting angles. His hair was thin, pale red and fuzzy. His mouth was thin. Even his eyes were thin, close slits of pale blue with no lashes. Campbell disliked him instantly. "I'm Tredric," said the Earthman. His voice was thin, with a sound in it like someone walking on cold gravel. "Terran Overchief, why do you wish to land, Black?" "I bring a message from the Kralan people of Venus. They need help." Tredric's eyes became, if possible, thinner and more pale. "Help?" "Yes, help." Campbell was struck by a sudden suspicion, something he caught flickering across Tredric's granite features when he said Kralan. He went on, slowly. "The Coalition is moving in on them. I understand you people of Romany help in cases like that." There was a small, tight silence. "I'm sorry," said Tredric. "There is nothing we can do." Campbell's dark face tightened. "Why not? You helped the Shenyat people on Ganymede, and the Drylanders on Mars. That's what Romany is, isn't it? A refuge for people like that." "As a Latnik, there's a lot you don't know. At this time, we cannot help anyone. Sorry, Black. Please clear ship." The screen went dead. Campbell stared at it with sultry eyes. "Sorry? The hell you're sorry. What gives here, anyhow?" He thrust out an angry hand at the transmitter, and then quite suddenly the Taxil was looking at him out of the screen. The hostile look was gone. Anger replaced it, but not anger at Campbell. The Taxil said in a low, rapid voice, "You're not lying about coming from the Kralans." "No, no, I'm not lying." He opened his shirt to show the tattoo. "The dirty scut! Black, clear ship and then make contact with one of the outer hulks on the lower tier. You'll find emergency hatchways in some of the pipes. Come inside and wait." His black, dark eyes had a savage glitter. "There are some of us, Black, who still consider Romany a refuge."